Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those of you who, like me, know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt. They're full of it. They are actually counterproductive. They cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interest, to understand why they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful, it's caring. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching, not law, because its liberating, enriching, and empowering covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. At any time over the next 3 hours, if you would like to participate in the show, our toll-free number is 877-300-7645. Of course, the world's attention is directed toward the Ukraine. Russian troops took over the Crimean Peninsula over the weekend without firing a shot. The newly installed government in Kiev, if you want to call it an installed government, it was a riotous coup in western Ukraine, was of course powerless to react. And despite calls by U.S. President Barack Obama for Russia to pull back its forces, oh my God, you better pull back or we're going to really attack you with some rhetoric, Western governments had few options to counter Russia's military moves. This morning we're going to talk about the Ukraine. We're going to talk about the press reports regarding the Ukraine. There is lots to know about the Ukraine. One of the things that we're going to speak of is how as it relates just to the Crimean Peninsula. It was an autonomous region of the Ukraine and therefore independent. And it is almost exclusively Russian. And so we should not be surprised. In fact, I told you specifically last week that Russia would take over this autonomous region of the Crimean Peninsula. Also, we should not be surprised that the eastern Ukraine is also taken over by Russia. It is about 40% Russian, and the people there are displeased with the mob rule that has taken over Kiev. We've talked about the Black Sea Fleet, which is not hugely important but on a world scale, but is important to the Russians, and the fact that the Russians are not going to let it become vulnerable, and they haven't. We've talked about the eastern Ukraine and the fact that it is and has always been considered, at least in the last many hundreds of years, part of Russia, and Russia is not going to let it go. It's not going to abandon it. And we've talked about the pipeline that runs through western Ukraine and how that the Friendship Pipeline supplies about a third of the energy it and other Russian sources, about a third of the energy for Europe. And they're not going to abandon it either.
Well, all their gas lines that go to Europe also go through Ukraine.
Yes, that's what I was speaking of. That there's the Friendship Pipeline. This is Scott, who is pinch hitting today. We're lucky to have you. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
The Russians supply a third of the energy for Europe and for all of Europe. Now, for Eastern Europe, it's about 90% of the energy. And it's not only natural gas that's being piped from Siberia and the area around the Caspian Sea via the Friendship Pipeline, of which there are two arms, one of which, the largest of which, goes through Western Ukraine, but also coal, also uranium, also oil. They are Europe is dependent upon Russia. It doesn't have any options. Very much like the United States, for it to rattle its saber and say, you ought to do this, we're going to put sanctions on you. The United States really ought to think. In fact, it ought to have made better decisions before it decided that it was going to try to make threats. You know, if the United States had developed the Anwar oil and gas reserves, if we had developed the oil and gas reserves off of the coast of West Coast of California in particular and off the southeast coast of the United States, if we had developed appropriately the oil and gas reserves in the Gulf of Mexico, if we had built the Keystone Pipeline to bring the Canadian oil down to American refineries, we would be in a position to say, you know, we think that sanctions against Russia are appropriate. Now, I don't agree that they are, but at least we'd have that option. But because we have been stupid in this country, we don't have that option. Even America's military would cease to function if it weren't for key Russian imports. In the rare earth metals, for example, upon which modern technology hinges, the only source is Russia. We ought to be really careful before we open our yap. But the other thing we're going to discuss on this program, and probably in the second hour, is what is the Ukraine's relationship with Russia? What has it been? Is there any difference, really, between the way America responded to the Civil War than what Russia is doing in Ukraine? Is there really any difference between Texas, for example, saying, you know, okay, we've been part of the United States for 150 years or so, so we want to declare our independence, and America is saying, no, you can't do that. You know, would a little history of the Ukraine be appropriate before countries start making threats? The other thing we're going to discuss further is why is the Ukraine in such a mess? Well, we devoted an entire program to revealing that the Ukraine is bankrupt. It's the first nation ever to be bankrupt with debt that is around 30% of gross domestic product. But nonetheless, it's bankrupt. It owes $15 billion that it has to pay back this year and has no money to pay it back. Another $16 billion next year. The Ukraine, just to stay afloat for the next year, requires $35 billion. And it will go through that money, squandering it, and will need another $35 billion the following year. Who's going to supply that? Who in their right mind would provide this kind of money to keep this country afloat? And the country now is largely, particularly in the West, a collection of deadbeats, of people who do not want to work, who want all manner of government subsidies, and who are producing smaller quantities of inferior products. And they are grotesquely anti-Semitic. Now, I'm not here to tell you that Russia is doing the right thing in terms of invading Crimea and ultimately, most likely, invading the eastern Ukraine. But I can tell you that standing up for the Ukraine as a viable, independent, and worthy nation among nations is ludicrous. There is nothing that can be done effectively here. So let's continue to consider the news reports on the Ukraine. Because, folks, it is important that you know that no matter how much money you spend on your military, it is counterproductive. It can't be used in this case. If it is used in this case, it'll bring about World War III. The consequences will be devastating. It's important you know that your politicians have gone to platitudes and half-truths, and what they say is far more untrue than it is true and exceedingly counterproductive. It's important that you know that. It's important to know that the media is no longer a source of news or information, but now simply part of the propaganda mechanism, serving up half-truths as platitudes, as if no one is capable of thinking anymore. And it's important to recognize that with Europe and the United States taking a position, and Russia on the other side and in league with China on so many issues, and with the President of the United States trying to present both Russia and China now as America's foes, we are setting up for World War III. Particularly when we recognize what's happening in Syria and how that's going to lead to not only Muslims beginning World War III when they have finished with Syria, but how Europe and the United States will be on one side, China and Russia on the other. And so in this rhetoric, in this hardening of positions, what we're moving towards is a conflict that is going to be more savage, more deadly, more destructive than all of mankind's wars previously fought combined. Here's the next story. Russian troops took control of vital installations across the Crimean Peninsula. By the way, they sent a few thousand troops. It was nothing. And not a single troop fired a shot. They were welcomed by the vast preponderance of the people, flag waving, anthem singing Russians. Vladimir Putin secured unanimous authorization for the move to send in even more troops if he wishes to do so. On Sunday, Ukraine's leader urged Putin to pull back militarily, saying, "We're on the brink of disaster," but Ukraine doesn't really have a leader. Yanukovych, the man that they deposed, was popularly elected. Now, he's a scumbag, but the Ukrainians have had a tendency to elect scumbags. So have we in the United States, so I'm not pointing fingers. The fact is, there is no legitimate leadership in the Ukraine. And the Ukraine does not speak with one voice. Hours later, President Obama, who had warned Putin on Friday against military intervention in Crimea, yes, he warned him on Friday, he invaded on Saturday. It's got to be the fastest turnaround in terms of American rhetoric being disregarded. It was a 90-minute tense exchange. Can you imagine Putin? Put him on speakerphone, was practicing martial arts in the background, doing something to entertain himself, because it's for sure Putin would not have the capacity to listen to Obama for 90 minutes. I know I can't do it. I can't imagine him doing it. Obama said that a refusal by Russia to send troops back to their bases in Ukraine would impact Russia's standing in the international community. Well, it certainly is going to with the United States and most of the knuckleheads in this country that don't want to think their way through issues, to actually come to understand them, to be reasonable about them. And it will do so to some extent in Europe, although most Europeans know that they're not in a position to criticize Russia because they're dependent upon Russia. We're going to return to this subject and continue to cover it over the next hour, maybe two, because it is the preamble to another world war. We'll be back after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. In Crimea and in cities across the eastern Ukraine, and we have pointed this out in a program last week, all you have to do is bring up a map of the ethnic diversity of the Ukraine, and you quickly find out that Kiev and northwestern Ukraine has a very small percentage of Russians. They represent about 5% of the population on average. Although there's very little difference, by the way, in an ethnic Ukrainian and an ethnic Russian. But in the east of the Ukraine, the population of Russians is about 40%. And in the south, it goes as high as 70%. And so it was obvious where the Russians were going to go. Anyway, it says that government opposition to Kiev's new government is running high in eastern Ukraine and in Crimea. But even that isn't an accurate statement. There is no new government in the Ukraine. I mean, what they had was a mob of people who were not peaceful protesters. Ultimately, by their violence, their Molotov cocktails, destroyed, ran out of town, the previous government. Now, the previous government was corrupt, but that's all they've ever known in the Ukraine. But they ran him out of town, and so now what you have is the effect of mob rule. Now, these mobsters in the Ukraine are not freedom-loving people. They're dependent. They made a decision, as so many people in the West are making, it's being made in the United States, to become dependent. To become dependent on government for all manner of handouts. And so they bankrupt their country. And so there is no freedom for the Ukrainians. They're either going to be controlled by the International Monetary Fund, of which they have borrowed three times previously, and all three times they welched on the agreement, the terms of the agreement. The International Monetary Fund isn't going to re-up without absolute control of the Ukraine, which means the country itself is going to be mortgaged to the International Monetary Fund. The Ukrainians are going to be serfs to them. Or they're going to get their money from the Russians and just going to have to swallow their pride because they are now bankrupt. And when you are bankrupt, you don't have any wiggle room. You have no negotiation. You are no longer free. You've mortgaged your future. You've mortgaged your present. And, of course, we should never forget that not only are the Ukrainians no longer motivated to work, that their economy has absolutely tanked, that they did not make a successful departure from Soviet collectivism, that they emerged from the Soviet experience unwilling or unable to work. They had a brief spike where they spent the government spent its way into bankruptcy, and that was followed now by another Great Depression. They've only been a country for about 20 years. And during this 20 years, it's been mostly economic misery. That's the reason that they're in the mess they're in. If they don't receive $35 billion, all of which is just going to go back to repaying previous borrowings, they're insolvent. The country doesn't exist anymore. It is insolvent. It's like a business that goes bankrupt, scrapped for the pieces. Also, we should never forget what Putin warned us about when the first of these riots broke out in Kiev. He says it reminded him of the pogroms. Pogroms is a Russian word that speaks of severe violence. The pogroms were begun in the Ukraine back around 1910 to 1915 and continued all the way through the 1930s and into the 1940s, where hundreds of thousands of Jews were murdered. In fact, even through World War II, the Ukrainians were especially willing to help the Nazis hunt down and kill 1 million Jews. It is a place where the Jewish population has declined from being the third largest ethnic group to only at 6% of the overall population of the Ukraine, now down to 0.2%, falling from over 1% just a decade ago. It's a mass exodus of Jews from the Ukraine, because the Ukrainians are grotesquely anti-Semitic. No nation should side with any nation whose people are anti-Semitic. Why are we siding with Ukraine? This article says that that Russian flags were raised throughout the eastern and southern Ukraine, that pro-Russian protesters outnumbered Ukrainian supportive protesters by over 100 to 1. At Kiev's Independence Square, there are now protesters once again, now protesting Russia. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mess. This next line I'm going to read from a Washington Post article just sums up the nature and attitude of what's occurring in the Ukraine. Ole, an advertising executive cooking over a big open fire at the square where he has been camped out for 3 months, said, "If there is a need to protect the nation, we will go and defend the nation. If Putin wants to take the Ukraine for himself, he will fail. We will live freely, and we will live freely." Ole claims to be an advertising executive. Yeah, he hasn't worked for months. People in Ukraine don't work. I mean, that's the problem. The Ukraine is not working. It's bankrupt. Even in Ukraine, where you know, they claim to be the world's second largest exporter of wheat, that's so misleading. First, they probably are in the top 10, but they're not second. And second, almost all of the wheat, at least two-thirds of the wheat that is exported from the Ukraine, is fodder. It's not suitable for human consumption. Even in Egypt, which is the world's largest importer of wheat because of the bankrupt Islamic economy, they have finally said, we can't take any more Ukrainian wheat. It has degraded massively over the last decade so that it is bug-ridden. It is filled with all sorts of parasites and broken, rotten. It is barely good enough for animal consumption. It's a feed crop, and it's diminishing at a very rapid rate. No matter what it is that you talk about in the Ukraine, it's failing. The Ukraine is vastly better off being integrated back into Russia. This experiment of independence has not worked. That's the reality. And there's no way to fix it. You aren't going to resolve this issue. And the very group of bankers or nation that attempts to resolve the issue by demanding that the Ukrainians be accountable, that they stop lavishing indulgences upon themselves, that they stop being dependent upon a bankrupt government, that they actually start working, is going to find that they're put in the position where the Ukrainians are going to build campfires in the square and protest against them while drawing a pension from the government that you funded. And you'll become the enemy. This problem cannot be resolved because of the nature of the people that we're talking about. He says there's a need to protect the nation. This has been a nation for 20 years. It was part of Russia, not only during the Tsars, but during the Soviet period, for far longer than Texas and California have been part of the United States. Do you imagine telling the U.S. government, if Texas and California declared their independence, that the United States couldn't intervene? What are we going to do? We're going to blow up the shrine to Abraham Lincoln in Washington, D.C., because he went after the South militarily when they wanted to be free and independent? Do we want to take it all back on what we did in the Indian Wars? Give them their land back and make apologies? Say we'll never use our military again? When Obama is screaming at Russia for intervening militarily, saying that that's a 19th century strategy that's failed, and now in the 21st century, what are we to do about our invasion of Korea, Vietnam, Panama, Afghanistan, not once but twice, Iraq, not once but twice, Libya, and what was a near invasion of Syria, one stopped because Putin outthought Obama. What is it about America being able to deploy its military muscle and invade countries around the world and bomb countries around the world, and that being appropriate, and Russia going into a country to flag-waving citizens without firing a shot to secure what has been part of Russia for centuries? I mean, we do not hold the high moral ground here. And to frame this issue the way it's being framed is that these people are independent and they have a rich history of being independent, and Russia is the bully, and invading them and precluding their freedom is just rubbish. And this is very dangerous rhetoric, because what we're doing is we're pitting superpowers against one another. It is childish politics on behalf of Obama. And he is having a temper tantrum in the midst of all of this, daring, threatening. It's dangerous. It's ultimately going to lead to world war. The reality is that the Ukraine is not free. It made decisions relative to its economics and its government dependence that destroyed its freedom. It's what we're doing in the United States. You ought to take a real close look at the Ukraine, because within a decade, that will be America. America has really become belligerent. We've become a nation that whose rhetoric is reprehensible. We've become the world's bully. And I don't say that because it's my opinion. I say that because it's God's opinion. It's his conclusion. I don't know if there's a big difference between an opinion and a conclusion when it pertains to God, but as I have completed the translations and analysis of Yeshaya 17 and 18, Isaiah 17 and 18, it has become overwhelmingly evident that God is really upset with America and that he has issued a very stern warning to America and said, you know, your rhetoric, your attitude, your military are not appreciated. They're irritating. And the consequence for this country in continuing its present course is going to be grievous because we are grieving the creator of the universe. America thinks that its military and its government are a force for good in the world, and it is exactly the opposite. We need to wake up. We need to change. We need more people to hold the media, our military, and our government accountable for this foolish behavior before average citizens are caught up in this mayhem, before God begins to view all of us with the same lens that he is viewing our military and our government and our media and their rhetoric, their failed morality. We have Glenn calling in from Philadelphia on the Ukraine. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, Yada, and hope you can hear me pretty well.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I had seen a program on CNN yesterday, Fareed Zakaria's GPS. Mm-hmm. And so I watched the propaganda channel, and mm-hmm. he had Madeleine Albright and Zbigniew Brzezinski on simultaneously, you know, him in the middle and one on either side. And they, you know, those are two of the most pernicious globalists in the world, you know, and
right.
they were just spouting right. their anti-Putin, anti-Russia garbage. And then after they were on...
And, of course, Glenn, it's so hypocritical because the ultimate globalists in terms of using military power to try to impose one's will on other nations is the United States.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were, you know, Zakaria kept, you know, saying that Putin was being a neo-imperialist, you know, sending his troops into another country. I'm like, you don't think the troops in 120 countries and we've done nothing but destroy other nations for most of my life.
Right.
And here Putin, you know, this is just insane. But he had a man on after them as a counterpoint named Joseph Cohen,
mm-hmm.
who writes for The Nation. He did an article in The Nation magazine talking about how the image of Putin is misconstrued. And this man was amazing. He spoke for 4 or 5 minutes. And he spoke of, Putin being a nationalist as opposed to, someone trying to reform the Soviet Union or to restore Russia to its former imperial glory, all this other stuff they were saying. And he talked about how Putin, you know, had this was thrust upon him. It wasn't his fault. He's not trying to...
Correct.
It was thrust upon him.
In fact, the United States was responsible for thrusting it upon him. We have the recorded dialogue between the Undersecretary of State and the ambassador to the Ukraine saying, screw the, they use more flowery language, screw the European Union, and trying to advance the protests that led to this problem. We lit the fuse.
Well, it's all NATO, OPEC, and EU nations that are fomenting all these coups all over. And they try to launder the assets through proxies and stuff to make things plausible for liability. It's just nothing but troublemaking. But,
you know, I look at Putin, and we did a whole show on Putin not too long ago, and I look at Putin and say that he is probably the world's best leader today.
Mm-hmm.
And he has his Achilles heel. His Achilles heel is that he is empowered largely because of the oligarchs. He himself is an oligarch, and therefore the economic corruption that he permits, and the use of prisons to silence opposition, is where he is vulnerable morally. Now, he's not. I'm not sure he's more vulnerable morally in that regard than most nations in Western Europe and the United States, but he is. That's his Achilles heel. But
yeah.
beyond that, he is a fairly articulate, fairly honest, fairly rational, fairly well-controlled leader who is definitely doing the right things for Russia.
Well, he's a nationalist as opposed to one of these globalists, you know. So, and that,
right, he is.
And this time, Cohen even spoke of the Russian, his treatment of the Jews in Russia as a barometer of, you know,
right,
his authoritarianism, you know, and how
right,
he's a softer authoritarian, and, you know, his treatment of Jews has been good. If you want to confirm that, ask Israel.
You know? Well, you know, then this fellow Collins is brilliant, because if you want to know about the character of a nation, look how they treat Jews. When you have a nation that, like Western Europe right now, that is becoming increasingly anti-Semitic, you know that there's something collectively wrong in their morality, their conscience.
His name is Cohen, and he teaches at NYU in Princeton. He's a professor at NYU
right,
in Princeton. He knocked it out of the park.
Yep, I'm not surprised. So have the stories that have come out from the think tanks specializing on Russia, the media, and our politicians have this wrong. The most recent news story out of Russia and its positioning its troops in the Crimean Peninsula is that Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Russia was defending human rights against ultra-nationalist threats, and that Russia's would remain in the Crimean Peninsula despite the Western condemnation of it being a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. Let's talk about the Ukraine. Because for most of history, there has been no Ukraine. And because there has been no Ukraine, it seems to me that we're repositioning this the Ukraine somewhat like the like Palestine. Now, I want to be careful here, because there really is no place known as Palestine, and there are no people known as Palestinians. There really is a place known as the Ukraine, and there really are people known as Ukrainians. So the myth of Palestine is far worse. But as an independent country, not so much. Merged as a the Ukraine in the realm of the Ukraine began to emerge a little bit during the Middle Ages, but it quickly disintegrated. By the middle of the 14th century, Ukrainian territories were under the rule of three external powers, and that's really the nature of it for most of its existence. This region was under the control of the Golden Horde. Now, most people probably haven't heard of the Golden Horde. Those are the Mongols. And the Mongols did not keep much of the territory that they conquered. They were primarily raiders. But Ukraine and southern Russia, going up even into Moscow, was part of the territory of the Golden Horde, the Mongols. They were also under the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. It's a European state in the 12th century, all the way up to 1795. It was founded by the Lithuanians, one of the polytheistic pagan Baltic tribes. It was a multi-ethnic and multi-confessional state with a great diversity. In other words, it was cobbled together and therefore unstable. The pagan state was targeted in the religious crusades led by the Teutonic Knights. And so if you are a proponent of Roman Catholicism, and particularly their imposition of power through their knights, this region was split apart during the Crusades of the Teutonic Knights. It was also, for a long period of time, throughout the 15th century, part of the Kingdom of Poland. And then since about 1569, there was this Crimean Khanate that was carved out of this region by descendants of Genghis Khan, one of the most ruthless barbarians of all time. In 1653, the greater portion of the population rebelled against the Polish Catholic rule in the region. And by 1654, an assembly of the people in the Ukrainian area voted to affiliate themselves with Moscow. That's what they chose to do. And then after the partitions of Poland in 1773 through 1795 and the conquest of the Crimean Khanate, the Ukraine was divided between Russia and Austria. Thus, the larger part of the Ukraine was integrated into the Russian Empire, with the rest of it under Austrian, as the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, in the mid-19th century, 1849. This was a chaotic period of warfare between the Russian Tsarist rulers, the Roman Catholic Austria-Hungarian rulers, with also shortly thereafter the Russian Revolution then commencing. And so this region of the Ukraine was either under Poland, was either under the Mongols, was controlled by Poland, or was controlled by, or divided between Russia and Austria throughout all this period of time, and then was integrated, of course, into the USSR. And there was no Ukraine as an independent state for all of this period of time. There was then a brief Ukrainian-Soviet war, which resulted in the Soviet army establishing absolute control over this region in 1919. The Soviet victory, the conquerors created the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And until 20 years ago, it remained integrated into Russia, a Russian state.